Well, John, thank you for that very generous introduction. And to the students, we, Ann and I both, really appreciate the invitation to come today and talk to you. There are non-students here as well, but my comments are really to you students because I remember so well, and I know Ann does too, finishing law school 24 years ago and wanting to have a public service or public interest career and having it seem kind of lofty but kind of vague at the same time, and how would we do it? And to have a chance to come back together 24 years after our graduation and tell you a little bit about what we've done and how, and maybe just offer a few humble and practical lessons for those of you who are interested in public service is something that's very exciting. It is the case that neither Ann nor I are UVA law grads, and so John put that out on the table up front, and I'll acknowledge that. Ann's father, Linwood, was the governor of Virginia from 1970 to 74. Her grandfather, Frank Rogers, was the rector of the board of the University of Virginia and a lawyer who founded the Woods Rogers Law Firm in Roanoke. Linwood Holton was from Big Stone Gap, and he went to Washington and Lee, served in World War II, and then he went to Harvard Law School right after he got out of service at the end of World War II. He decided that he wanted to practice law in his native Virginia, but Big Stone Gap was a little smaller than he had in mind, and so instead of going home, he went back to Roanoke, and he walked into the office of the largest law firm in Roanoke at that time, Woods Rogers. Frank Rogers, the founder of that firm in the 1920s, was as dedicated a fan of UVA undergrad and law school as existed. He walked into the interview with the founder of the firm, Frank Rogers, and you have to remember Lynn, even though he's from Virginia, had not spent much time in Roanoke, and so he was getting used to this new city and the new law firm, and Frank asked him this question: were you on law review at the university? Hoping to duck the law review question and instead impress Frank, he said, Mr. Rogers, I didn't go to the university. I went to Harvard Law School. And Frank Rogers says, I hope you have a wonderful career. Lynn got even by marrying Frank Rogers' daughter about 3 years after that. Which then Ann results from that union. But so we have some ties with UVA, including Ann's brother Dwight, who graduated in 1996 and is a public service lawyer working as a U.S. attorney in Portland now. The years at UVA were great formation for him. And I know through Dwight and also through John and others here, through talking with Brian and Allison, UVA has a great record of commitment to public service. I gave the UVA undergrad commencement speech in May and found two stats I love about the UVA undergrad, that UVA has put more people into the Peace Corps and in the Foreign Service, both of those, than any other university. That says something powerful about the undergrad's commitment to public service. But the law school has a notable record as well, the amount of pro bono hours that law students do here, over 12,000 last year, the loan forgiveness programs that UVA has for students who go into public interest careers, the student-funded scholarships for those who pursue public interest jobs in the summertime, and this conference are all tribute to the fact that the law school is very much on a public service mission, and that makes us particularly happy, Ann and me both, to come. And really, what I wish I had done when John had asked me to give the speech is immediately get it on Ann's calendar and say, we'll both give the speech. Because what I'm really just going to talk to you today about is the breadth of what public service law means. Because we in 24 years have done a whole series of different things. It's important for those of you who are interested in public service law to know, as John indicated in his introduction, how broad public service is, how many options there are. That's a great thing. And if I'd thought to get it on Ann's calendar a few months ago rather than 3 or 4 days ago, we both would have been standing up and giving the speech. But I want to really just basically talk about our careers and the lessons we've learned along the way. And that really is the message that we would both want to share with you today. For those of you who are interested in public service, there are so many ways to do it. There are so many ways to do it, and that's an exciting thing. If you want to serve other people with your law degree, you will never be short of an opportunity to do it on any day that you practice law in a lot of different ways. Let me say a quick thing, just quickly give you Ann and mine's own public service or what we've done with our law degrees, because you'll get a sense of the breadth of it. Ann was a law clerk for Judge Robert Marriage, a federal district judge in Richmond, a courageous judge. She then served from 1985 until 1990 as a full-time lawyer with Central Virginia Legal Aid. from 1990 to 1995, during the early childhood of our two oldest boys, she served as a part-time lawyer at Legal Aid, working 3 days a week. From 1995 to 1998, she took a 3-year leave of absence from Legal Aid when our third child was born, but worked as a substitute judge in the General District and Juvenile Courts in the city of Richmond, filling in for judges who were sick or on vacation. From 1998 until I was elected governor, she was a juvenile court judge in one of the most challenging courts in one of the most challenging jurisdictions in Virginia, dealing with the very, very tough issues that face families and kids. When I was elected, she did not have to step down being a judge, but a variety of factors made it the right thing to do. But what she's doing now as First Lady is using a passion from her juvenile court days, the plight of older children in foster care who will likely never be adopted. And she has put together a program called For Keeps, the goal of which is to connect teenage foster care kids who won't be adopted with a parent or other mentor so that when they turn 18 and they're not in foster care anymore, they got a place to go on summer vacation. They got somebody who'll call them on their birthday. They have a place to go when they're in college, and it's Christmas break. Making permanent connections between teenagers who are in foster care and adults that can last them for their entire adult lives. That has been the quick summary of Ann's career. I was a law clerk, too, with a federal appellate judge in Macon, Georgia for a year, Lanier Anderson, and then worked for 17 years with two private law firms in Richmond in the private sector. Billing hours, doing all the things that private sector lawyers do. I eventually became the managing director of a firm that's now McCandlish Holt, and it was McCandlish Kane when I was there. 60 lawyers on three continents, 130 employees, a Main Street firm in Richmond. But the core of my practice for those 17 years was plaintiff civil rights work, largely trying to help folks who were turned away from housing either because of race or disability. About 10 years into my legal career, and as I was practicing, I was also a part-time professor of legal ethics at the University of Richmond. I got mad at my Richmond City Council one day. I don't know if any Richmonders are here. It's a very common reaction that all Richmonders have. And in fact, probably everybody who lives in any jurisdiction has. But when I got mad at my city council, I just decided I would run for office. Never thought about running for office, but just got mad one day and did, and ended up serving twice as a city councilman, then twice as mayor, lieutenant governor, and now governor. So just with our two careers in 24 years, we've been government lawyers, legal aid lawyers, private sector, judge, judicial law clerk, elected official, professor of legal ethics. We've done an awful lot of things that are broadly defined as public service. And we haven't scratched the surface. We haven't been public defenders. We haven't been prosecutors. We haven't worked in an attorney general's office or at the federal level. We haven't done public interest lobbying. There are so many public interest public service careers that we haven't even touched. We've been pretty busy in what we've done, but there are so many things that you could do in the public interest area that we haven't even touched. And that would make me, if somebody had said this to me when I was 24, 25, getting ready to graduate from law school, I would have found that a hopeful thing, that there's so many different ways to serve. I want to just give you five practical tips about how to build a public service career, trying to use some lessons that Ann and I have talked about, and then I'll conclude and say a word about why to build a public service career. Five tips about how to build one. First, if you want to be in public service or public interest, I think the best way to start is to decide what the community is that you hope to serve. When we were in Harvard Law School, and I don't know, it might be the same somewhat here at UVA, there are a lot of people who are interested in public interest kind of broadly defined. And you could go to a placement office, and there were some public interest employers that would come to the placement office at Harvard, and not all that many. You could look in some catalogs and some books to try to research options. But those of us who were interested in public interest law at Harvard, we kind of thought, well, it was probably legal aid, or maybe one of the signature public interest groups like the NAACP Legal Defense Fund or the Southern Poverty Law Center. We didn't know that much about what the options were. What Ann and I, when we decided to get married, sort of toward when we were law clerks, decided to focus on is we wanted to be public interest lawyers, but I didn't really know exactly what that meant. But we made a wise decision somewhat accidentally. I think it proved wise in retrospect. Was we decided, let's focus on places that we would like to live where we could be in service. and we decided we wanted to live near one of our families. So we right away chose Kansas City, where my family is, or Richmond, where her family had lived, and proved the better negotiator. So we've been in Richmond for 23 years now. But what we found is once we picked cities and then spent time in the cities, we became aware of so many options where there wasn't information at the law school placement office, and nobody on the faculty would have been able to tell us anything about it. We became aware of law firms that never sent anybody to interview because they were just too busy working. We became aware of public service opportunities that didn't send information to law school placement opportunities. We became aware of fantastic neighborhood organizations and civic organizations that use lawyers, if not full-time, on volunteer basis. And so I would say maybe the first thing to do if you're thinking about a public service career is ask what is the community that you hope to serve. Largely that will be a geographic question. I think if you narrow down your geographic search, it will enable you to get really deep into understanding the needs of a community, and you'll suddenly become aware of opportunities. But it might not just be a geographic narrowing. Maybe the community you want to serve is a particular interest group or a particular cause. But in some ways, begin by asking yourself the question, what is the community you want to serve? More than a vague interest in public interest or public service, I think that will really help you get started. And it proved that way with us, because coming to Richmond, and I remember saying kind of to each other when we looked at the various options we had, and Ann started as a legal aid lawyer, and I started working with a private firm. We kind of had the sense in Richmond, rightly or wrongly, that the harvest was full and the laborers were few. There were other communities where there are tons of people doing public interest law. In Richmond, there weren't necessarily tons of them. But that was exciting, too, because it made us feel like we wouldn't just be a fungible, commodity or a drop in the bucket, that we might be able to really make a difference in people's lives. And so that would be another thing about picking the community. I know at Harvard, and I don't know if it's quite the same at UVA, an overwhelming percentage of our classmates went to very, very large cities: Chicago, New York, San Francisco, Los Angeles, Houston, Boston. A small percentage went to smaller cities. I think it's a wonderful thing to focus on smaller communities, because smaller communities really give you the ability to have a great effect. So first rule is pick the community first that you want to serve, and that'll get you oriented the right way. The second thing is, and this is real practical, be realistic about the salary you expect to make. I have a lot of friends who wanted to be public interest lawyers, but they also wanted to make the same salary that everybody else at Harvard Law School was making. And that's just unrealistic. It's unrealistic. I mean, it's fair to want to have it all. Everybody wants to have it all. But, if I can give you very practical advice, it would be this: get used to living on not a lot of money, on a little bit of money, and then you'll have the freedom to do what you really want to do. Because a lot of people get used to living on a lot of money, and then they feel chained to having to make a lot of money, and they feel that restricts their options in terms of doing what it is they want to do. So if you can live beneath your means, I guess, is what I am suggesting to you, and be realistic about salary and what you would expect to earn if you pursue public interest, you're going to have a happy public interest career, and you're going to make a good salary. It might not be what some of your classmates make, but compared to the median income of Virginia or the median income of the United States or the median income of the neighbors you'll be living with, you're going to be doing fine. When I joined, I was with a firm, my first firm. I told them when I signed up, I really want to do a lot of pro bono work. And they said, sure, we know, that's great. Well, I don't think they'd ever had somebody there who really wanted to do a lot of pro bono work. And so I found very early that my desire to do a lot of pro bono work was creating some real conflicts with the firm I was in. And so I switched to another firm, and I went in up front. I had met this firm and in the courtroom, and they liked what I did, and they wanted me to join them. And I said, I really want to do a lot of pro bono work. And we negotiated a deal pretty much up front where I started at two-thirds of the salary that others were making who were in my level of experience. But they gave me latitude to do pro bono work. And then they gave me latitude to run for elective office. There were times during my 17-year career, there was one year in my 17-year career at my law firm where I was the managing director and I was the mayor of Richmond, and I was making less than a first-year associate. because I wasn't billing a lot of hours, and the hours that I billed were on a case that was a pure contingency case that I worked on for 6 years, virtually full-time, with no revenue coming in until the very end. And then we actually did pretty well. But there but there was a lot of period along the way where I was at my firm, I was making less than a first-year associate, even though I was the managing director of a firm where a lot of the partners were doing very well. Every once in a while, I got envious of others. I would see what people were making and see, you know, what folks were driving, and I wasn't driving what they were driving, and I wasn't making what they were making. But my firm didn't owe me dollars for doing work that weren't bringing dollars in the door. My wife Ann worked at Legal Aid and then worked part-time at Legal Aid. A cum laude graduate from Harvard Law School could earn a lot better salary than she did as a Legal Aid lawyer, definitely as a part-time Legal Aid lawyer. But we focused on what it was we wanted to do, and then we adjusted our lifestyle accordingly and got used to living on a lot less than we might have made. And that trade-off is not one that we've ever questioned. We've been extremely happy, and we've made a good living. It just hadn't been a good living relative to others we went to law school with. One year we got a survey that they send out on like a 10th anniversary of our law school class, and they asked you to fill out all kinds of questions about your happiness with your profession, et cetera. And then at the end, there was you were supposed to check boxes about your income level, and both Ann and I were in the less than the bottom income box. But, again, that's just relative to a standard that's not the real-world standard. That was just relative to Harvard Law School grads. So that's the second thing I would say to you. If you want to be about public service, you have to be realistic. If you really want to make a commitment to public service, there will be folks who are sitting next to you here in class every day. You may have had better grades than them, and they're going to make a lot more money than you. But you can do a lot of good, be very happy, and make a fine living, even if not, maybe not what others are. So that's my second tip. My third tip is this, and this is really Ann's tip. Ann has this theory that she has had for a long time, even back to the day we were in law school, that you lead serial lives. So the decision you make about where you go after you graduate from law school is not the last decision you're going to make about your career. You don't need to feel too stressed out about making it perfect, because we all lead lives now where you don't go to the same law firm and stay there for most of your career. That used to happen. That's not what happens now. And so law clerk, legal aid lawyer, part-time legal aid lawyer, stay-at-home mom, judge, first lady, law clerk, private sector lawyer, public servant, you do different things over the course of your life. And that's good. And that takes some of the pressure off some of the decisions that you have to make, because they don't have to be perfect. One of the things I learned very early on in my legal career is I focused a lot in making the choice about where I first went on what kind of work I would be doing. And I didn't focus a lot on the question of what I thought about the people that I would be working with. And I learned that the people that you're going to be working with is actually a much, much more important thing in some ways than the technical kind of work that you'll be doing. But you can get that all right, you know, as you get out, again, focusing on a community, getting into a community, really wanting to change a community. You can get that all right. You can change. You can grow. You can take different positions. It's not just that you can. You will. I can say that about really virtually everybody here. Your career path will take you in twists and turns and to places that you didn't necessarily think you'd end up, but that's a very positive thing. And if you look at your career that way, not as a, you know, I'm going to do this thing in public interest law and here's the goal that I'm shooting for in 30 or 40 years, but as a series of opportunities, many of which you don't know today, I think that's the realistic view of careers. And it matches the point that I wanted to make that I made earlier, which is the great thing about if you want to be public interest or public service, there's so many ways to do it. We started our career, legal aid lawyer, you know, private sector lawyer. It was not a month into my work at my private firm wanting to do public interest law, but still kind of having a vague understanding of it, that somebody walked in, asked a partner who referred it to the newest lawyer of a fair housing case. You know, I hadn't really thought in. I'd never taken a course about fair housing, didn't know the fair housing statutes, hadn't really thought about it, but I was the low man on the totem pole at my 12-member firm, so suddenly this was my case. Well, I ended up taking that case and then spending 60% probably of my 17-year career doing fair housing work all over the United States. And so be open to, you know, kind of new experiences and twists and turns and changes. Once you get centered in the community where you want to make a difference, these opportunities will appear to you, and that is an exciting thing about what it is we do. Fourth tip. The first three are kind of, I guess, more, since we're lawyers here, procedural rather than substantive. Pick a community. Be realistic about salary and expenses. Recognize that you'll have serial careers and build that. But I'm going to make two now that are more substantive about kinds of things to focus on. And so the fourth tip is this. I think there's still an incredible need in this society for people who want to be about racial reconciliation. I just see that so powerfully today. We're right now, and I would encourage you to do that in your own way, whether, you know, at your firm, in your civic organizations, in your neighborhoods. I would encourage you to do that. We're celebrating right now, celebrating for some, commemorating for others, 400 years of Virginia. Jamestown was established in May of 1607. It's a great celebration because it was the expansion of English-speaking civilization to the New World. It was the birthplace of elected legislative bodies in the New World. It was the first place, really, on this continent where there was the interchange between native Virginian, European, and African cultures on Jamestown Island. The values that those settlers at Jamestown brought grew into notions of the equality of all people in the Declaration of Independence and freedom of religious worship in the Virginia Statute of Religious Freedom. And much has happened in those 400 years, and so it's a celebratory year for some, but for native Virginians, it's not exactly a celebration. The early history and even to today, history today is painful for African Americans who came first to Jamestown in the New World in 1619. As Martin Luther King used to say, we were here before the Pilgrims landed at Plymouth Rock. African Americans were in Virginia before Plymouth Rock in 1620. It's not a celebration. Again, there's a lot of pain along the way. But even today, there's need. There's great need for people who are about racial reconciliation, broadly defined. I am the governor now dealing with a legislature and a tough legislative body. I've had to witness on the floor a very divisive and kind of unusual debate this year among legislators about whether Virginia should officially express any sense of remorse or apology for slavery. And I can't believe that it's that hard, really. But it was very hard for some legislators to do that. Virginia wasn't an innocent bystander when it came to slavery. No, Virginia enshrined and perpetuated and venerated and defended through drops of blood an institution. And to say that Virginia regrets that, wish it had never happened, apologizes to those whose current lives are still affected by that legacy seems straightforward. But the fact that it was hard to do for some in the legislature tells me that there's still a real need for people who can work to build bridges. This year in the legislature, about 50 bills got introduced that, to varying degrees, are bills that are punitive towards new Americans. Now, immigration policy is an important thing to get right, and there are important things that you have to do to make the immigration policies right. But so many of the bills that I see that get introduced, I think, really go beyond trying to strike the right balance in immigration policy and instead try to take advantage or exploit xenophobic feelings about people whose skin colors are different, whose accents sound funny, who speak a different language, who wear apparel that is unusual. And I see that in our politics, and I see that in our communities today. You know, if Pocahontas hadn't saved John Smith's life twice, we might not be here. So one of the original Virginia values is welcome to outsiders. And if we go down a path, whether it's in policy or just in the way we treat people in this area of immigration, of pushing away new Americans, we will have sold out something that was very, very basic about the original Jamestown experience. And so what we need in our communities, and this is a public service you can provide in your workplace and in your church and in your neighborhood and in your school, we need people who are bridge builders, who are going to work to continue to make more perfect, in that great phrase out of the Constitution, to make more perfect our fidelity to the ideals of equality. it is a powerful thing when you think about it that Jamestown was the place where Native Virginians and the European and African cultures all mixed together for the first time in the soil of this hemisphere. That's a powerful thing. And you can almost look at the story of our nation as a story of that very experiment. Then with folks from Asia and other nations as well mixing in, that's really been the story of our country. But there's a tremendous amount of work to do, and lawyers are uniquely situated by training to do it, to be bridge builders and try to build bridges across racial lines, build bridges across ethnic lines. And I'll say one more thing about this before I go to my last tip, is that not only should you do this because it's the right thing to do, we should be bridge builders and focused on reconciliation because our future really depends on it. We are in a global world right now where nations around, we're not competing in Virginia against Charlotte and Baltimore anymore. We're not competing against Los Angeles and Boston anymore. We're competing against Singapore and Mumbai and Hong Kong. We're competing with regions and nations around the world. And the competition is at base a competition for talent. The most precious commodity in the world today is not oil and it's not water, it's talent. And talent comes in all shapes and sizes and all ethnicities. And no nation that pushes people away or sends a message, or no commonwealth that sends a message that people aren't welcome, will win in the talent race. You know, I was struck just over the last few months, and you know, in the senatorial campaign, an issue came up about our welcome, you know, to folks. In this case, a University of Virginia student who was a Virginian, a native Virginian, but of Indian origin, our welcome to him. This debate about the slavery resolution in the floor of the General Assembly, that some of the comments that have been made about a recently elected member of Congress who wanted to use Thomas Jefferson's Quran to take the oath of office. When we send out a message that we're not welcome to all, we're not just selling out on some really important values that are Virginia values, we're also sending a message to the world that, gosh, if we want to do business in North America, and most do, and we ought to look for another place, a place where we'll be more welcome. I spend a lot of time trying to get international businesses to come to Virginia, and I've had some success, but I groan every time I see one of these instances that might suggest to the world that we're not a welcoming commonwealth. And so this is something, again, that you can be uniquely situated as lawyers to do, and I would just say, one way to do it, one way that Ann and I have found to do it that really is, there are many opportunities to do it. Ask yourself this question. Am I, in any major part of my life, in a minority, in a racial minority? And if your answer is no, then find a part of your life where everybody isn't like you, a church, a civic organization, a neighborhood, a workplace, and get deeply involved in that place over a long period of time. And try to learn, and try to be a bridge builder, and try to be a reconciler. I had the great fortune of serving as mayor of a city that was 65% African American. I learned an awful lot along the way that I didn't know before. We had the experience in supporting our kids in the public schools in Richmond of being in a lot of classrooms where we were in a minority, and learned what it was like to some small degree for the thousands and hundreds of thousands of millions of people who have been in minority situations in virtually their entire life. It's an important thing to learn. And it gives you the ability to try to build bridges. And so that would be my fourth recommendation to you if you want to build a public service career. That's still so needed. I see it every day in this Commonwealth and in this nation. And the fifth, I just can't get away without saying this. Hey, run for office. You know, one of the things, I'm an optimist by nature, very optimistic person. My mother told me, you know, if you want to be right, be a pessimist. But if you want to do right, be an optimist. And I decided I would rather do right than be right, so I'm an optimist. But every once in a while, I do get slightly pessimistic or down about our prospects in the future. And the two things that make me feel down a little bit as I look 25 or 50 years down the road in our country are these: declining voting participation rates. You know, when Ann's dad was elected governor in 1969, 65% of registered Virginia voters voted in that election. When I was elected governor in 2005, 45% of registered Virginia voters voted in my election. So what's it going to be 20 years from now? I mean, if it's 25 or 30% 20 years from now, I posit that we will have to come up with a new word to describe our form of government, because the word democracy will not apply really meaningfully to a government where there is universal suffrage, but the overwhelming majority of people choose not to participate. We will have created a new form of government never known on the history of the planet, and we'll have to come up with a new word to describe it. The other thing that makes me feel a little down sometimes is how hard it is to get good people to run for office. It's increasingly hard. I talked to my Republican friends about this. We're in a year where every legislator is going to be up in November. And I talked to them about this issue of, boy, you know, I got to admit, I'd like to beat some of your guys, but it's kind of hard to get good people to run. And they say, you don't need to feel too bad because we're seeing the same thing on our side. Many, many law firms have explicit policies that their lawyers are not able to run for office because they might want to do some business with the city or the state or work on a bond issuance that the state does. And so many law firms have that now as an explicit policy. I just am fortunate that the firm that I worked at had never had anybody run for office before, didn't know how hard it would be, and so they didn't have a rule covering the situation when I went to them in 1994 and asked them to do it. A huge number of the folks who graduate across the street at the Darden School will go to work with financial institutions, and because they do bond financing for governmental units, make it off limits for any of their employees to run for public office. So much of our talent pool in this Commonwealth and this country work now for institutions where there is an explicit written policy that you are not able to run for office. Now, some of that is because of ethical rules that have some validity, and, you know, we've got to be careful about those. But I am starting to feel very, very nervous about, you know, the best and the brightest, you guys. If you guys aren't out there in 5 or 10 or 15 years trying to run for office, well, we're still going to have office holders. It just won't be people that have your wonderful skills and training. And there are a whole series of reasons why people don't run for office, the publicity and the financial sacrifice and the time away from families. And if you make a mistake, you'd make one in full glare. You know, if you make a mistake in your private life, you make it surrounded by people who know your good side. They'll give you the benefit of the doubt if you're entitled to the benefit of the doubt. But in public life, you make a mistake and you make it in the glare of a lot of people who they don't like politicians anyway. They're not going to give you the benefit of the doubt. They want to assume the worst about you right away. There's a lot of reasons why people don't run for office. If you put pluses and minuses on a T chart, if you're trying to make the decision, the minuses will always be more significant. But I will say to you, having been in public office now for 13 years, it has been the most marvelous experience. Even with the various headaches, it's marvelous. I can drive by schools in Richmond that wouldn't have been built had I not been a city councilman and mayor. And I know that politicians, and especially ex-politicians, have a short shelf life, and my political career will come to an end, and 2 or 3 years later, people will look at me and say, didn't you used to do the weather or something, you know? but when that day comes, I will still be able to be in my car and drive by a school that I got built, and if nobody else remembers it, I'll remember it. And I'll have that feeling every day for the rest of my life, being able to see things in my community that my thumbprint are on because I got into public life. And that is an enormously satisfying feeling. And so despite all the negatives and despite all the challenges, I would say to you, you are very well suited. Law training, you know, people joke about too many lawyers in politics, but I tell you, legal training is a wonderful thing for being in public office. Some of it is because of the obvious. You know, you're reading text, you're reading laws, you're reading cases, and that's what legislators do. So you're trained to do the things that public office demands. But I think the real reason that lawyers are good in public office is because of temperament, is that you get used to, if you represent clients, I did in public life. You know, I had to be a zealous advocate for my client, and the guy on the other side was being a zealous advocate for his or her client. And we would fight very hard in the courtroom. But if we couldn't step away from our client's dispute and civilly engage with one another and talk about discovery and, hey, can you give me a few extra days for this? Or, hey, let's work on when the trial should be scheduled. If we couldn't civilly work those things out and step away from the dispute our clients had, then we weren't going to be good at our job. And lawyers, whether they're in a negotiating context or in trial law, learn that pretty quickly, that you've got to be able to maintain a civil relationship in order to do the job that you need to do. And what I see in public life is a lot of people who take conflict too personally. Brian, you voted against me yesterday. Man, I'm going to make your life miserable. Or Allison, I can't believe that, you know, you said what you said about that bill that I put in. I see people who don't have the kind of legal training that we have finding a conflict in views as something that's personally threatening and then letting it erode a relationship that hurts their effectiveness down the road. But lawyers have a way of understanding that and letting the problem of the day go by. And you may have voted against me today, but tomorrow I'm still going to work on trying to get your vote and we're going to have a good relationship. And so that's my last tip to you of the five ways to have a public service career. I hope some of you will think about running for, you know, city council or school board or Commonwealth's attorney or the General Assembly or running for Congress, because we need people with legal training. I believe deeply we need it. We need people with legal training and the kind of skills you bring, and good people, people with great educational backgrounds of all kinds, legal or others. We need them in public life. I'm going to conclude and say I've given you some tips about how to build a public service career. Focus on the community first. Be realistic about what salary you hope to earn. Recognize that you're not trying to build a career. You're going to have serial careers and be open to that. Be voices and bridges of reconciliation between people. Think about running for public office. But let me finish and just talk about why to be in public service. And in some ways, I don't have to do that because this is a self-select audience. If you weren't already sold on the mission, you wouldn't have come here on a Saturday when you could have been seeing the Florida State game or, you know, or doing a lot of other things. You wouldn't have come here to listen to this. But John mentioned that when I was at Harvard Law School, I took a year off and went to work as a missionary in Honduras. And I say for two reasons, it was the single best decision I've ever made in my life. The first reason is because it really reoriented the way that I thought about my career and what I wanted to do and what I had to contribute. And I'm going to share that with you in a second. But the second reason it was the best is I started off in Harvard a year ahead of my wife, and it was a very large school. And had I not taken a year off and then gotten out of sync and then ended up in her class, I'm not sure we ever would have met. And so I always say that decision, you know, just worked out so wonderfully well. But I took this year off at Harvard because I was a first-year student, and I was surrounded by a lot of very self-assured people who really seemed to know what they wanted to do in life. And they might have been good actors. Maybe they didn't know what they wanted to do in life, but they seemed very self-assured. And I didn't really feel that way. I'd gone through college at the University of Missouri in 3 years, and I had a vague sense of wanting to do public interest work, but I didn't know any lawyers. I mean, and I didn't really know what that meant. And so in the middle of my first year, I thought, well, you know, maybe if I took a year off and I spent some time, I could really kind of get my head straight and figure out what it was that I wanted to do. I had this contact through my high school, a Catholic high school in Kansas City, with a mission in Honduras. And I just wrote them and said, can I come down and volunteer for a year? And they said, sure, come on down. So I told the dean and told my parents and told all my friends, I'm leaving. I'm going to go do this. Most of them didn't expect to see me back. They were like, well, you must not like law school, or, you know, they had their own thoughts about why I was doing this. But the year turned to be a very, very powerful year for me. And one thing that happened in that year, and Ann's heard me tell the story way too many times, but it is, you know, if you ask, you could probably all ask yourself the question, what's the best piece of advice anybody's ever given me? This is my story of that. I was in Honduras, and I was running a vocational school teaching kids to be carpenters and welders. And that was a powerful experience and in many, many ways working with these students. But during the times we would break, there would be a Christmas break or another break, I would often travel up into the mountains with priest friends, Jesuit priests, to go village to village and visit people. And this one friend of mine, Father Patricio, who is still, Ann and I went and visited him on our 20th anniversary 2 years ago. yeah. Just seems like 25 years. No, that's not good. Patricio and I, over Christmas of 1981, traveled up into the mountains of Honduras, and we drove the four-wheel drive vehicle as far as it would go, and then we got out of that, and then we got on mules, and we would just go to village, celebrating Christmas Mass in this very, very poor area, very poor country, second poorest country in the Western Hemisphere after Haiti at the time, and probably still is. We got to these villages, and the trend would be kind of the same, or the pattern. We'd arrive at a village, and they might not have had a priest there for 5 or 6 months, and so we would prepare for one of these mega masses that would be, there would be 5 weddings and 10 baptisms, and, you know, and everything all at once, a big community celebration. They were really exciting. We would usually arrive by mule, and the children would surround Patricio, and he would have a bag with these little penny candies that he would take out and hand out, and the children would dance around as if it was the, you know, best Christmas present that they'd ever gotten. We got to the farthest village in this circuit that we did, and Patricio said, hey, before we get ready to set up to say Mass, let's go say hey to this family that he knew that had kind of helped him out when he had been there before. So we went to visit this family, and it was a husband and wife and a couple of young kids. Very poor area, way up in the mountains in Honduras. This time, the Christmas time of year, the weather's, you know, kind of crummy, rain all the time, and not real cold, but uncomfortably cool with all the rain. Family lives, like most of the other families in this village, bamboo walls and thatched roof, and windows were just open cuts into the bamboo. And we walked in, and this family was obviously very, very poor. Their children had some of the classic signs of kids that had malnutrition, which was very common in the country and in the folks that we visited there. And we visited with the family for a little bit, and then we were getting ready to leave and go set up and say Mass. And the guy, the husband, said to Patricio, hey, wait a minute, Father, and I have a gift for you. And he went and he got a little bag, worn rope bag, and he gave it to Patricio. He said, Merry Christmas. Patricio opened it up, and it was filled with food. Now, Patricio had a physical resemblance to Santa Claus. He had not missed a lot of meals. And I was 22 years old, and like a lot of 22-year-olds, thought I knew everything. And I kind of had this very visceral reaction. It's like, wow, you know, I can't believe Patricio is going to take this food from these people. These kids definitely need food. The guy had gone further up into the mountains and picked all these gourds and vegetables up there, and he gave them to Patricio. And, you know, so we turned to walk out of the house and go back to set up for Mass, and we were walking, and I was just thinking, hey, I can't believe Patricio did that. These kids need that food. And Patricio is a very, very smart guy, or maybe wise would be the better word. He knew exactly what I was thinking. I didn't say anything, but he read my mind just perfectly. And we just walked for about 2 minutes in complete silence, and he knew the vibe that I was sending off was a very cold vibe. And then he said this to me, and this kind of, to me, this has been my piece of advice that's kind of been at the heart of my public service career. He said, look, Tim, you got to be really, really humble to take a gift of food from a family as poor as that one. Didn't say anything else. Now, it was not advice in the classic sense. He was not giving me a lecture. But I've just thought about that so often over the course of, that was, you know, 25, 26 years ago. I've thought about it so often because there are two kind of truths in there that really, to me, are truths about why do public service work. I mean, the first one is the exact really words that he said, which is you do have to be humble. You know, all of us have been helped yesterday, today, and will be helped tomorrow. And some of the people who help us we know, but many of the people who have helped us we don't even know to thank. And no matter how good our law school is or our GPA is, none of us really have the full package. I mean, you can't get stuff done if you're not willing to recognize that you stand in the need of help from others. And so that was a very powerful message. But the second part of the message was the one that kind of occurred to me a little bit later that really is about public service. Patricio was basically saying this to me, that, you know, I could have turned that food away, but what's more important in life than being able to give? And so the most ennobling thing about being a human being is that we all have something to give to somebody else. So even people in the most unlikely circumstances, unlikely seeming circumstances, have something to give. And that's what really leads to, you know, tremendous satisfaction in life. It's not salary and it's not your resume. It's having something to give, and everybody has something to give. Well, since that time, that really made me then come back to Harvard. And everybody was surprised to see me back in a very different place. I didn't really care about what the salaries were, you know, for the summer jobs that were being offered. And there were a lot of things that were important to a lot of people there that had been important to me before I left that weren't important to me when I came back. what was important to me is just simply, all right, I got some, you know, talents. I got my own humble collection of talents like everybody else. Can I use them to benefit other people? And at every step along the way, when I've had a decision to make, I've just asked myself a basic question. Look, if I make this decision, will it enable me to use the gifts I have to serve others? Or will it enable me to encourage that in other people? And if I can say yes when I ask that question, it's like, fine, then I'll do it. And that really is the reason. That's the why about a public service career, which you knew before you came in or you wouldn't have come in, which is it is the way to lead a deeply satisfying life. Since that experience, you know, at that time, dealing with some of the poorest of the poor, I hadn't had many experiences at the other end of the phase. You know, my parents were middle class and my dad ran an ironworking shop. But now, having been governor and mayor, I've dealt with the richest of the rich. I've now known and befriended some of the richest people in the world. And so now I can say I've seen the full spectrum, you know, from the poorest of the poor and from convicted people on death row to the richest people in the world. I've never known somebody, no matter what their physical circumstance or their income level, who was a giver who wasn't happy. And I've never known anybody who wasn't a giver, no matter how much they had, who was happy. And so that basically, you know, there's altruistic reasons to do it for others, but do it for yourself. Do it for yourself so that you can wake up every day excited, that you can look in a mirror and ask yourself that question, am I doing something to use the skills I have to benefit others, and am I encouraging others to do the same thing? And being able to say yes to that question is about the most satisfying feeling there is. So let me say thanks again for the chance for Ann and me to come up and just share a few minutes with you and talk about what a marvelous opportunity you have before you. I mean, you have got so many exciting opportunities and twists and turns in ways that you can lighten somebody's load or make somebody's life better before you with the training that you've received. I mean, it's exciting to be in a room and just kind of think of the possibilities multiplied by the number of people here. You're going to do a lot of good, and we really thank you for the chance to come and share a little bit with you today.